This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Learn how to write a memoir. This is the book. Okay, and so the second thing was I felt like I wanted to tell you all about my life. How often do people come up to you and just start spilling out their personal secrets?
First of all, thank you. I'm really flattered by those words, especially coming from you, who I respect so much. How often? Every day. There has not been a day for more than a year that I didn't hear from, first of all, hundreds of people, and often meeting hundreds of people at my events. The book signings are really intense because people come and they share their stories with me. And I also get hundreds of emails a day. And one thing that's really interesting to me is you begin talking about the book and you end up talking about yourself and your own story. And so people say, I loved Wild and here's why. And there's some strand that resonates with them. Now, sometimes it's all of the strands. It's grief, or it's the love of the outdoors, or it's having to go on a journey in your youth to find yourself, or it's having a marriage that ended young, or a father who was abusive, or a mother who died. Any of those things that people connect with in the book, or love of backpacking. And they tell me what piece of it resonates with them. And when I first started to get these emails, I've received several emails and met several people who say, we've had the same life. We've lived a parallel life. And what I've found is really, I think that we all think that we're more unique than we are. Of course, we all live our lives as individuals and originally, but we have so much in common. There are really so many things that connect us. And this has been driven home again and again here in the U.S. But what's happening now is Wild is coming out all over the world. And it's really interesting. I met this woman, for example, last week from Korea. She came to one of my readings. I was reading in North Dakota. And she said, I just came from Korea and I read your book in Korean. And I related to this and this and this. And she related to all the same things that Americans relate to. And I've had this experience with the Italians, with the Dutch, with any number of people from various cultures. And that tells me something. That tells me that in writing my story, I really was writing the universal story of what it means to be human.
Well, I think you were. I mean, you totally have been. And I think that's what makes telling your personal story the most relatable to people.
Well, and I think what I did is I really wanted to tell the true story of that time in my life. And I decided to focus on the hike, not because, I took the greatest hike that's ever been taken. The point of Wild is not that I did this amazing thing that no one else can do. You know, I think a lot of us go on long journeys of one sort or another. And I really wanted to tell the true story of what I did with my profound grief over my mother's death when she was 45, of how I came to grips with my sexuality and my sort of my sense of myself as a young woman who had not had great role models, in my father for certain, but really in other kind of relationships, and also just that rite of passage that we all go through when we're trying to figure out our path in our 20s. And I think that's something people in all age groups can relate to.
Well, I'm also stunned by the vivid details, because it's hard sometimes to even remember things from yesterday,
Yeah.
So how did you recall every single moment of this amazing adventure, this amazing life journey?
Well, I think one of the things that people forget when they read a book, really what's happened is the writer has gone on a deep journey of remembering, of trying to access those experiences and those things that, in regular life we forget. The thing I can best compare it to is you're going to your, 20-year high school reunion, and you're thinking, I don't remember anything. I'm going to forget everyone's name. Who even remembers what happened way back there? And then you go, and suddenly those memories are reopened. You start a conversation. Somebody says, well, remember when we did this or that? And you're saying, yes, now I do remember. And so you're remembering something you thought you forgot. Writing from memory is a muscle I've been working for more than 20 years. I've always drawn on my life, even in fiction. My first book, Torch, is absolutely fiction, but it has autobiographical seeds. And you know, the self has always been the place from which I've mined, you know, so much of my material. And so it's something that I'm constantly engaged with. I also, as a kid, had a sort of legendary great memory. But also, you know, I think that one of the things that our culture, this isn't really true in many other cultures, but our culture has a really hard time, I think, understanding the form of memoir. It gets this bad rap for being, you know, the narcissistic form, or, you know, when really that person is trying to use the self to tell a universal story. But also, you know, I think that memoir asks you to make that leap, to say, you know, am I certain that every vivid moment I conjured for you in Wild is absolutely 100% accurate? Do I know that the wind blew the hair across that man's face in that moment? Absolutely not. But I'm telling you a true story, but also trying to make it come alive for you. And so I allow myself to remember the full-bodied scene, knowing that, you know, there are going to be some things that I'm mistaken about. The wind didn't blow at that moment. Or the chair, there's one case I write in Wild, I mentioned that there's an Adirondack chair on a deck. And later, somebody who goes to this place, you know, where I wrote about, said, "Well, it's not an Adirondack chair. It's, you know, it's a plastic lawn chair." And I'm like, "Well, you know, okay, but in writing a memoir, you do have to make that leap and say, this is how I remember it. The form is the art of subjective truth, and so the reader has to say, this writer is creating this vivid portrait of me the way she sees it in her mind's eye and the way she remembers it."
That leads me to what I've been wondering about. If people have contacted you that have met you, that maybe you may or may not remember. You did contact people that you stayed in touch with, but were there people who said, "Oh, I saw you," or "I was there at that time"?
Many, yes. Many of the people who I met on the trail and wrote about in Wild have contacted me and reached out to me and come to my readings and such. And then there's this whole other layer of people who I had brief interactions with, some of whom I don't even remember, people I chatted with along the way. There's a woman who I chatted with at Crater Lake National Park, and she said, "I remember you. We had this conversation," and she had written about me, you know, in her journal. "I met this woman who was hiking this long way on this trail." And you know how you have those brief interactions with people, and some of them I remember, others I don't. And she came to one of my readings. It was cool, you know, and she said, "It's totally you. I remember." And so that's been a really cool part of the experience, is reconnecting, you know, with people, in some cases who I had, you know, I hiked with a couple days, or other people who I just met briefly. The book had a way of bringing everyone back to me.
Did you find yourself like just doing some sense memory exercises, looking at photographs, meditating, just to recall? Because I'm just astounded by every single detail that was so clear and in the moment that's in the book. And that doesn't quite often with memoir. Sometimes there's huge chunks of description and sometimes not.
Yeah, it was a combination of things. My journal, I kept an avid journal. If there was one thing I could change about the book, I would write about keeping that journal more, because that's a question I get a lot. Did you keep a journal? And I do mention it in Wild, but I only mention it in passing. And I did that only because I thought it would bore the reader to say, you know, I had my dinner and then I sat down and wrote in my journal, which is essentially what I did. And oftentimes I would meet people, you know, in the middle of the day, and they would walk away and I would immediately take out my journal and write the scene. And because I was really a fiction writer by then, I would write it, you know, it's in my journal, you know, in dialogue and, you know, description. I wrote it the way, you know, a writer would. And noting details. And that was incredibly helpful when I was writing the book. Last year, when Wild came out, Powell's bookstore asked me to do a blog for the first 5 days of the book's life. And one of the blog posts I made, and it's still online on the Powell's blog, is I wrote about the process of using my journal and of writing the book. And I even photocopied scanned some images online of actual pages from my journal. And you can read those pages and see, you can find the place in the book that I used that information. And sometimes I would write about what the landscape looked like, even if I didn't know, you know, what kind of plants those were, what kind of trees, I would describe them. Now, the other thing I did, that was, I would say, the hardest thing for me as I was writing Wild, because I passed through so many different landscapes and I remembered what they looked like. But I, you know, once I was writing Wild, I went in and said, well, what kind of wildflowers were there? You know, I remember them as yellow flowers. Well, I go and I find out, well, they were monkey flowers, you know? And so I was able to sneak in some of that information that wasn't necessarily what I was aware of at the time. I also talk to people I met on the trail, people who I was in touch with, and ask them for their memories. You know, I think that any writer of nonfiction, you know, certainly I'm also giving myself over to the subjectivity of the endeavor. This is how I remember it. I'm going to interpret people and events and experiences and even landscapes through my own subjectivity. And yet I still felt a great obligation to tell the truth to the greatest extent possible.
I'm Dee Mae Roberts, stage and studio. I'm talking with Portland's own Cheryl Strayed, author of Wild, Torch, and Tiny Beautiful Things. To learn more about her books, visit CherylStrayed.com or visit stageandstudio.org, where you can also hear this entire interview. Strayed's rise to fame this last year has changed her life, and I asked her how she and her family have adapted to the change.
Well, I have to ask you about fame, because people who have known you in Portland, who have known how hard you've worked, have been nothing but applauding because you have worked so hard to get to this point. I think everybody that I've talked to has said how proud they are of you and how proud to know you they are. So at what point did you know that Wild was going to take off?
Well, thank you. First of all, I do want to say I feel so grateful for the community here and the support I've received from Portlanders and really just also the national writing community. I've heard over and over again from my peers, it's so great to see when one of us makes it, you know, because I am one of us. I'm just a lowly writer like many, many other writers. And I don't believe myself any more worthy than honestly hundreds of other people I could name right now. You know, there are so many great writers. And I know that you know, having your book on the bestseller list is not necessarily a measure of quality, you know. And therefore, I didn't let that be the measure of success. All those years that I was toiling away as a writer, the question I was always asking myself is, have I done the best work I can do? And then let the chips fall where they may. And, you know, the one question I get so much about this past year is, well, how, you know, how has fame changed you? And how has all of this changed you? And my answer might seem false or insincere, but I can truly say, you know, I really feel like it hasn't changed me at all. You know, that the experience of fame is so strange in that it's completely outside of who I am. It's really this projection, this decision that other people have made about you. And that has been sometimes a strange experience. I you know, at my signing, sometimes people will cry and say, you know, I'm so nervous to talk to you or so. And I know how that feels because I have felt that in meeting writers I admire at times too. But what I always say is, well, it's just, I'm just me. I'm just like you. And that, you know, that sort of thing that we put around people based on their external success is sort of just a false premise, you know? And I think that it has been, you know, an incredibly gratifying experience, and it's one that I still haven't absorbed. So your question, like, when did I know it was going to be big? What happened is it was just this train that started rolling down the tracks, and it just kept going faster and faster. You know, before Wild came out, I started to hear from a lot of booksellers and magazine editors saying, and radio show hosts, people in the media, essentially, who had read the book before it came out. And they would say to me, I love this book. And so I started to have this sense that there was a lot of support. And then Wild was published in its debut week. It was number 7 on the New York Times bestseller list, which is something, you know, every writer, I think, dreams of that moment. And certainly when I got that news, I was in a hotel room in Boston, and I hung up the phone from my editor, and I cried. And I thought, I could not believe that moment had arrived, that moment had been given to me. This moment that I had known, I can't expect. I can't even really hope for. And I would have been just fine if Wild had gone off the list. You know, just that one week, being on the New York Times bestseller list in the top 10, that was enough for me. And not that I'm not ambitious, I'm an incredibly ambitious person, but I've always put my ambition with my writing, not with those things like the bestseller list. And so when it kept going, when it stayed on the list, and then Oprah Winfrey called me and named it as part of her book club. And then
she called you.
She called me on my cell phone. She called me. You know, it's so funny.
Did you believe it when she called you?
Well, I recognized her voice. And I think so many people, one thing I just want to say too is, you know, this process, I've had this front row seat, you know, into this thing that was always mysterious to me before. And what I can tell you is I'm a lot less cynical about the way the world works than I was a year ago. And that is because, you know, I guess I always sort of thought, well, you know, those Oprah picks, it's some, you know, marketing scheme and some committee. And, you know, and really the only thing was that Oprah read my book and loved it and called me up. Nobody knew about any of the book club, any of this stuff, but me and Oprah. Okay. She called me directly, proposed it to me. I said, sure. And then she went to her people and she called, you know, her people called my people and all of that stuff. You know, the machinery around being an Oprah pick happened. But it was because she loved the book. The same is true of Reese Witherspoon optioning it. How it happened, people always say, well, how did you make this happen? And it was, well, Reese read the book and she, you know, loved it. And she wanted to make a movie about it. That's how it happened. And so much good that's happened, you know. And then I think too, you know, with Oprah, you know, it went to number one. And then readers took over. They started to be the people who said to each other, you have to read this book, which is, of course, you know, the best thing of all. And it's a great reminder to me, too, that, you know, Oprah is just another reader. She's just a reader who happens to be incredibly famous. There again, that thing I said, you know, that's that projection we put around her. But she's a human who loves books, and she just happened to like mine.
And I love how you say you're a lot less cynical now because they're all just people, right? Mm-hmm. But I have to ask you, how was it to meet Robert Redford? Because I would like melt like butter.
Now that one, I have to say, you know, I've hung out with Reese Witherspoon, I've hung out with Oprah.
But Robert Redford.
Robert Redford. I mean, really, and when I met him, I said, Bob, you know, because he's Bob to me now. Oh, I said, you have been a movie star my whole life. And he sort of cringed.
I mean, the way we were.
I know. And he said, well, how old are you? I said, I was born in 1968. And he just laughed and shook his head. And he's the sweetest person, the humblest, most lovely man. The amazing thing was, you know, when I met him, I was really stunned. I was like, wow, this is Robert Redford. He really has been an icon, you know, my whole life. And he acted as if the honor was all his. He really just, he wanted just to talk to me about my book. He was asking all kinds of questions and really such a humble, kind person. It was amazing to meet him. He kissed me 3 or 4 times on the cheek.
And you didn't wash for days, right?
I
wouldn't have.
Still haven't washed.
Well, I'm just so glad for you. I mean, I'm kind of tearing up now just because this is the kind of thing that you really wish for a good friend, you know? Not, I mean, we've just met, but, mm-hmm. you know, I think because of your book and your books, you just feel like you're really a best friend and you're just telling your story, you know, just one-on-one. That's what it feels like to read your books.
Thank you. That means everything to me.
I want to know how all of this has affected you because you're on the road so much now. How has it affected your writing?
Well, it's really been incredibly challenging to write this year. And that's okay. You know, I remember I have 2 kids who are 7 and 8. And I remember when each of them were born, I made this decision to say, you know, don't beat yourself up about writing for the next few months. It's okay. You know, you have a baby. Just take some time off. And I've had to do the same thing with The Success of Wild. I've written several pieces, you know, around the edges, but I haven't really sunk back into real writing, what I call real writing, which is working on the next book. And, you know, I'll do that. There will be a time for that. One of the things that has been really challenging, you know, on top of having to set my writing aside, is I am a mom and trying to balance being present for my kids, who are by far the most important thing in my life, with my career. And, you know, also, you know, my husband is Brian Lindstrom. He's a filmmaker who has just had a film come out. There's a lot going on in our lives. And we as a family decided, you know, that this was a big moment and I had worked so hard and so long for this moment, I wasn't going to shrink from it. And I think that that's a really important thing that I teach my kids. I've always taught my kids to rise to the moment. When the moment comes, don't be sitting there in your chair. Stand up. And so I have given myself over to helping midwife this book into the world. And I also really look forward to things calming down a bit in a few months. And, you know, my writing will still be there. And my family will still be there. And so that's, you know, that's been the thing that's kept me going.
You have ideas?
I do. I've, you know, I think what I'm writing next is a novel. And it's set in Portland. I don't like to talk about, you know, books I've not written yet too much. But I will say that every time I open that document where, you know, I have written some of it, my heart starts to thump in only that way that writing can do. So I'm really excited about it. It's going to be unlike anything I've ever written before.
Well, you have a lovely family, and I got to meet your kids, and they're just so sweet and so beautiful and well-mannered, too. I mean, they're just really great kids. There's a story that you've told about how this little game that your mom taught you that you do with your kids. Would you tell us about that?
Yes, that's so sweet. I wish they were here, too, and they could explain it. What's so great is they play it just the same way I did. My mother... we used to play this game where we would, my mom would say, "How much do I love you?" And I would hold my hands, maybe a foot apart, and she'd say no. And then I'd go wider and she'd say no. And then I'd go wider and she'd say no until I couldn't reach the furthest I could reach. And she'd say, "No, that isn't how much I love you. I love you beyond reach." And that is really the way I love my kids. And they know that's how much I love them beyond measure. Beyond measure. And I really think in my work too, as Sugar, in my Dear Sugar column, which was collected in Tiny Beautiful Things this past year, I really believe that that's one of the most essential things that we can give to our children and to each other too, to love those we love beyond measure.
Are you still doing Dear Sugar?
I haven't been doing it this past year because I've been so busy. I did write a couple columns that were published in, winter and spring of last year after, I Wild came out. But I have, like you said, been on the road. I've been going nonstop. I never, ever imagined that I could work this hard. I have worked harder than my head is spinning. And so it's really been hard for me to get to that kind of quiet place that you have to get to write. But that will come someday.
What was your motivation to do Dear Sugar? Was it because you have had so many people come up to you and tell you, their whole life stories?
No, I took on the role of Sugar in March of 2010, and it was an anonymous endeavor, an unpaid gig, like so many I've done before as a writer. And I just did it because it seemed interesting. I'm always looking for something new. I'm always looking to try new forms. And I just thought, it would be so fascinating to essentially get the opportunity to grapple with other people's problems. As a fiction writer and a nonfiction writer, I'm always grappling with those things. What does it mean to be human? What are our conflicts? What are our contradictions? Where do we triumph? Where do we fail? What face do we show the world? What face are we really? And all of those things were presented to me by way of the Sugar column. And so I decided to, the advice column is sort of a misnomer because anyone who's read it knows that these are really, they go beyond that genre. They're really literary essays. And so I gave it, everything I could as a writer. I applied the full force of my humanity to those columns. And so it ended up being really interesting work for me. But there again, that's why I did have such a crazy year last year. On top of all this stuff we're talking about with Wild, Tiny Beautiful Things came out in July. It too was a bestseller. It too demanded a lot of my attention. So it's been, it's like I gave birth to twins last year or something.
You say that it might die down in the next few months, but really? Do you think so?
Maybe it's just wishful thinking. The paperback is just coming out now. It will, I'm going on this big paperback tour in April and May. I'll be all over the place. And then in the summer I'm doing, and in the fall I'm doing several appearances around the world in Brazil and Poland and different parts of the world because Wild is coming out there as well. And so is Tiny Beautiful Things, actually. But what's happening for me is I'm just starting to say no to more things, to say, okay, I've visited Nashville and I've read, three times in Portland and I've gone to New York and I've done, I've gone to Calgary and all of these things that I have done, I've done my time. And there will be a time where I have to shut the gate. One of the things I've really tried to listen to, and I write about this a lot of Sugar, is that inner voice. And that inner voice was the voice who said to me, rise to this occasion. It's hard to be away from home. It's you miss your kids, but don't short yourself on this front. But that other, the voice is now saying, okay, time to go back home and do the work again and go back to regular life. So I don't think, it will be exactly calm, but it will be calmer. That's my goal, calmer.
Thank you for taking the time to do yet one more Portland interview, but it really has been an honor to meet you and to just get to know you, even though I feel like we're best friends.
Thank you. I know a lot of people feel like they know me through my books, which is a wonderful thing, because I think it really eliminates any of that sort of cocktail party chit chat you have with people. People walk up to me and they do, they hug me. They say, Cheryl, I know you. And they tell me things about themselves that they wouldn't otherwise. And I love that.
That was author Cheryl Strayed. You can find out more about her books at CherylStrayed.com. Hear this entire interview again at stageandstudio.org. And while you're there, check out a feature story about her filmmaker husband, Brian Lindstrom, and his film Alien Boy. And don't forget to like the Stage and Studio Facebook page at facebook.com/stage-studio. Or tweet me with your events and comments at stage-studio. That's it for this edition of Stage and Studio. We had music today from Clark Salisbury. Till next time, I'm Dee Mae Roberts.
There's a grave crisis happening just off the southern coast of the United States. The hunger strike at Guantanamo Bay prison camp has entered its third month, and reports say men have lost between 30 and 40 pounds, some slipping in and out of unconsciousness. JTF Gitmo officials call the hunger strike a weapon that men are using to manipulate the system. Join me, Linda Olson Osterlund, on a deeper look this Thursday morning, April 11th, at 9:30 a.m., It's a day of action to close Guantanamo and end indefinite detention. I'll be joined by Pardis Cabrillai of the Center for Constitutional Rights. That's the Guantanamo hunger strike and the day of action, this Thursday morning at 9:30 a.m. right here on KBOO.
I'm Joseph Gallivan. This is Art Focus on KBOO Radio. This week our guest is Seth Tane. Tane is a realist painter who depicts industrial maritime scenes, as well as street scenes from San Francisco and New York. His current show is called New York, New Work, and only runs until April 13th. That's this Saturday. You can see it up till 6 p.m. this Saturday. And it's at the gallery at 929 Northwest Flanders, so 9th and Flanders in the Pearl. Welcome, Seth. It's lovely to have you here at KBOO.
And thank you for adding me to your illustrious lineup of Art Focus guests, Joseph.
So you paint realistic scenes of maritime industry and street scenes. So just tell us what we can see in the gallery. What's on the walls?
Well, I have 39 oil on panel paintings ranging from 6 3/4 inches by 10 up to 4 by 6 feet. And they're in two rooms in the gallery, all paintings done between 2007 and last month. And then there's a 25-minute color video with sound that I shot in the New York City subways last month in a small projection room in the gallery.
So your background includes, you used to ship heavy sculptures in New York City for sculptors such as Mark de Suevo, in the 1970s. And you also captained ships, and you manufactured tugboat pilot houses. You ran a marine salvage business in the waters around Portland. Just tell me first how you got into moving sculptures around.
Well, I have to back up just a half a step. I had a lifetime of accumulating too much stuff, tools and equipment, and it made me a little tired of carrying that stuff up and down flights of stairs as I moved from one loft or region to another. So I looked for a mobile solution, and back in 1979, this resulted in both the search and eventual finding a small oil tanker, which was located in New York, and I wanted that as liveaboard studio space.
So this was a ship?
This was a small ship, 140-foot, 5,000-barrel little coastal tanker. So we were anchored in New York Harbor. And word got out to the large-scale sculpture community through the 6 degrees of separation that there were some hippie artists living on a ship in Hoboken, and they had a crane and a boom truck and knew how to use them. The other problem was that the sculptors were used to having traditional rigging companies move sculpture, and there was a poor fit between the aesthetics of some of these riggers with their antique equipment and greasy handprints and snarky comments about the artwork. So the sculpture crowd was glad to find people who were a little more sympathetic and sensitive. And we began moving multi-million dollars piece of sculpture in and out of fifth floor windows and museums in New York. We formed relationships with people that we certainly never would have gotten to know had we been shopping our slides and looking for representation.
So you had been to RISD, the Rhode Island School of Design, and you were a painter, or you wanted to be an artist at that point? You were early 20s at this point, right?
Correct. I had majored in sculpture. I was there for 2 years. By the middle of my sophomore year, I realized I really just wanted to make art. I wasn't interested in teaching it. I didn't need a piece of paper to tell me I was ready. So I left to go ahead and begin making art on my own.
Mm-hmm. So you're living in New York, and you had this, you're living on a giant, what seems to me a giant boat in Hoboken in the water, and you turned it into livable quarters. Is that right?
Well, initially the idea was just studio space and liveaboard, and I became enamored of the maritime life, sort of slid down the slippery slope into the water, got my captain's license, learned to dive, began doing salvage operations in the New York Harbor. So some of those spaces got turned into machine shops and fabrication spaces, put cranes.